Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 182, featuring Aaron Kuferman. Before I get too much into Aaron, I want to make a quick announcement about the podcast itself. There's going to be many changes happening to the podcast, and I am going to be, because those changes are going to involve more work, one of the repercussions of that is I'm no longer going to be releasing the podcast at Sunday evening LA time. So I'm going to be releasing them Monday morning, which means that the reason I used to do that is that at Monday morning in Europe, a lot of our listeners are in Europe, would have the podcast ready Monday morning. They will now be available Monday evening or Tuesday morning for them to listen to. So hopefully that's not a big issue for you guys. I'm just shifting the schedule by a day. But like I said, there's many things coming forward with a podcast, so hopefully you guys will enjoy those as well. Let's get into Aaron real quick. Aaron and I have known each other for years and years, but we sort of been out of touch except for a casual email and Facebook posts and stuff like that, and reconnected personally recently. And he is professionally known for being an incredibly good compositor. I worked with him over at Sway many years ago, and also at Digital Domain and places like that. He's worked on numerous films, including Alice in Wonderland, Avengers Infinity War, and a bunch of other really great ones. One of the ones he's coming up recently that I know is going to be one of Lon's favorite films of all time is The Meg, which is about a giant shark that's versus Jason Statham. So I think that that will be an interesting one coming up. Sure to be action-packed. But what I really sort of, one of the things that connected a lot with me with Aaron is his photography and is his knowledge of photography. And that is mainly what we talk about on this podcast, because I have always respected and admired his knowledge of photography and use it a lot in my professional work, because photography is such a critical part to the lighting and compositing part of visual effects. If you have a good, strong knowledge of actual photography, it really, really works. And he is very, very good at it. And we talk a lot about his techniques and how they apply to different things. And I think that they're fascinating. His car photography is incredible. It's not studio car photography. It's outdoors in context photography. And he does car races, which is a skill set in itself and a very challenging one. And I think that you could really, really learn a lot from what he does in his car photography, because it's incredible. So hopefully you guys will learn and appreciate some of those amazing things up there. Announcements, besides the podcast announcements, we also, you guys obviously know that V-Ray Next for Max is out. So you guys should go check that out. V-Ray Next for Maya is in beta, and that is available for download for you guys to try out if you guys want to try it out. Of course, because it's beta, we rely on your feedback. And so if things are not working or things are not working as you expect, or you'd like something specifically added to this, that is what the beta is for. That is your opportunity to contribute back to this group and also get the things that you want working. So definitely give us feedback. That's what we really appreciate. The other thing is SIGGRAPH is coming up. It's not far away, and it's looking like it's going to be absolutely huge for us. Several big things we will not be able to announce until SIGGRAPH itself. In terms of our V-Ray Days talks, they are looking to be huge. We can't quite announce all of them yet. There's still some things that are dragging out, but we will expect to have those announced in the next week or so. But they're going to be some amazing talks. So follow us on our social media if you want to get more announcements quicker. Facebook, of course, Twitter, Instagram, etc. And that's just for just look for Chaos Group and those groups, and you'll be able to follow us there. Or you can just go to chaosgroup.com and check out what's new in that section there. But there's going to be some big announcements, and I'm really, really looking forward to telling you guys all about it. I'm very, very excited. It's just that I have to bite my tongue right now. But make sure that you guys pay attention to that. All right. Hopefully you guys will enjoy this great podcast with Aaron Kuferman. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays In high dynamic range, we know that ambient occlusion is passé. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
How you doing? Good?
Doing great.
In a world.
You could do an In a World.
Without Fresnel. One man.
There is no such word, there's no such thing as a world without Fresnel.
That's why.
Although
you saved the day and Steve, hit the switch and turn it on.
Steve Preak told me that there is one exception to a material that does not have Fresnel. It's called unicorn blood.
What about like that NASA deep black material or?
Oh, you're talking about the
or like some
stuff that's made from nanotubes.
Something like that. Yeah.
Right. It's the most non-reflective material in the world.
Yeah. I mean, I guess.
Yeah.
That would be easy to.
It's supposed to be the, it's interesting. I bet you it still has a Fresnel of some kind.
I bet you could zero out all your values and you'd be fine.
Okay. But yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. But I bet you there's some ray of light that will reflect off that thing at some point.
You scatter enough, you'll do it.
You'll scatter enough. That's right. So listen, I want to talk to you about this gear.
Yes.
Because I was struggling with this, and I had gone to Bulgaria, and I had traveled with this podcast gear for years, and after a while, going through many, many an international flight, obviously it collapsed and wasn't going to do well anymore. So Lon told me, he's like, why don't you get two sets of gear, one that stays in the office, and then one that travels with you. And so I kind of knew what I was going to do for the in-office stuff, and I got this setup, which we're dealing with right now. And we got this new stuff here, and you were the one who told me about it, because I knew about the H4N, but I didn't know about the H6.
Two is better.
It is two better.
Two better, yeah.
Yeah. And I love it. I love the fact that it comes in this nice little case. Look at this.
Yeah, and all the extra mics and all the inputs. I mean, you could have the stereo for on location and have people mic'd up and get all six channels.
I know.
It's great.
I know. And you're like me. Like, you learned audio on the fly a little bit, right?
Yeah. But it's all fly.
Yeah.
Nothing formal.
Nothing formal. But this was, I do like the Zoom stuff because that's, you know, the system, unfortunately, through all the travel that broke. But this seems like it's way more about traveling with this stuff, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So this is, when I travel now, this is going to be my new preamp. And then what also convinced me, and I wouldn't have thought of it, honestly, Aaron, if it wasn't for you, was to consider using lavalier microphones for podcasting.
But the wired ones, because the wireless ones are super expensive. And they're, you know, you have to have a new battery every single time you run it.
And there's no reason for it.
Right.
For a podcast.
For a podcast, yeah. Even if you go like to a show and you're doing a quick interview, you can just say, here, slap this on your shirt, and you can just stand there and talk, and the wire hangs down, and it's just fine.
It's just fine. Yeah. I thought about that. I was like, I didn't know that was going to really work or not, but it works out just fine. To go with a wired microphone. And I think, you know, this basically reduced, if I'm looking at these four bags for these four microphones and this little Zoom thing here.
And that box you can simplify. You can get a separate little kit.
I can.
You don't need
I can.
That hard case.
And these soft cases are overblown. I'm actually, I found a good hint on YouTube for how to pack these safely and in a more compact space. Hard glasses cases.
That works.
So if you put a hard glasses case and you put these labs in there, they'll be perfectly protected in a hard case. And then I just stuff this all in my backpack. This is, you know, probably a fifth the weight of what I was dealing with before.
Yeah, and the size.
And the size. So I don't know. I definitely know that my podcast will sound differently than it did before, because everything always sounds different.
And it'll suffer. It'll suffer so bad.
Really?
No.
I know it'll sound different, but
I don't think anybody will care.
It was really cool. It was really cool. And I really appreciate you loaning me your H6 so I could like be convinced to do this, because I think it's going to change my life.
Yeah, you need to try it out for sure. And
yeah.
You did, and it works.
It works great. And the Zoom stuff is great. It's actually really cool. And actually, the other thing I like about it is that I don't necessarily need to record directly to this device. I can actually still plug it into my laptop and it can record right. directly to there. So
right.
So that's interesting. But, you know, it's interesting when you came up to me, it's like, I've got this stuff. You may want to try it. Because it came from you, I immediately knew that, yeah, I need to take this information seriously. Because you've always been a guy who knows about stuff.
I have a gear addiction.
You have a gear addiction, but you've also researched things really well. Like, for example, we just had a conversation just before we started here. Like, hey, I want to put some cables together. What's the best cable collector system that you've got? And I would take that seriously.
And I popped the phone out and showed you. And you may or may not like it. It works for me. But
what got you into that? Like, you've always had a thing about, like, equipment that is good for, you know, art. Because are making art stuff.
Well, I go by the buy it once and buy it right. I've failed many times with many purchases in the past and grown to the point where, yes, it'll cost more money, but you won't have to buy it three times. I mean, when I was in art school, I went through three tripods until I figured out that, oh, wait, I should just buy a nice one. And, oh, that one has lasted me for a decade and a half now.
Right.
Great.
Yeah. It's like my grandfather always says, I'm too poor to buy cheap shoes.
Yes. Yes.
Right.
But also, like, I guess going back, I was going to go into engineering coming out of high school.
Okay.
And
I got a camera
as my graduation present. So I got into art, but like, I've always had the engineering mind. I've always been very like technical.
So you went in high school, you thought you were going to be an engineer.
And yes. And actually I'll nerd out. Okay. I was the president of my amateur radio and electronics club for a couple of years.
Total geek.
So yes, I will own that.
Yeah.
But it was cool because we actually had, there's a program with NASA called SAREX, SAREX, Shuttle Amateur Radio Experiment.
Uh-huh.
And when I think it was between my junior or senior year of high school, but what SAREX does is they coordinate with high schools in schools around the world to have them do amateur radio contacts with the space shuttle while it's on a mission.
Uh-huh.
And our school, our radio club, was chosen to be one of five for STS-71.
Where was this?
This was out in Redlands, Inland Empire, inland from LA, about an hour and a half.
Oh, yeah. Real close.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So our school was chosen, and we actually like set up and built a, you know, $15,000 two-axis antenna tracking, a satellite tracking antenna and a whole radio rig and all this stuff just to do this thing with the space shuttle. We had all the local media, we had local politicians out for it, and we had a whole big event. We invited all these like elementary school students and high school students from like all the neighboring areas to come in so they could ask the astronauts questions.
What year was this?
That was in 95.
Okay.
Yeah. And it was actually STS-71 was the first mission where the space shuttle docked with the Russian Mir space station.
Oh, the space shuttle
docked. Yeah.
And you were from your high school.
Our high school electronics room right next to the gym. We had this giant antenna that was like tracking the sky as the space shuttle flew overhead. And I was the president, so I initiated the contact, and, you know, KB5YSQ, KB5YSQ, this is KO6FP, Redlands High School, come in, you know.
Wow.
Like, did the whole thing, and it was a direct radio, like, back and forth. There was no data link or whatever. Like, that was just radio to radio. They had—
Yeah, but it's just straight up in the sky.
Straight up in the sky. But and all they had was a handheld radio with a wire antenna taped to the window of the shuttle.
This is amazing. I see everyone always says, like, I don't know what I'll talk about on the podcast, and suddenly this story comes out.
Right.
This is an amazing story. And first of all, it does not surprise me coming from here. Like, this sounds exactly like something you would do. But yeah, that's amazing. I can't believe you spoke to the astronauts.
Yeah, and like
you initiated a call.
Yeah,
and everything?
I initiated, and
oh my god,
and I was actually a little nerve wracking because like I did the initiation, there was no answer.
Well, of course, they're not there yet.
Okay, no, like they were up. Like we got the tracking data from NASA,
right?
And we're on the phone NASA. They're like, we can hear you, but like you can't hear us. Or
was it a bad Skype call?
And yes. Yeah, somebody didn't pay their internet bill. And I guess there's a difference in polarity with antennas. And we had ours set to, I think it was right-hand circular polarization, and it was should have been left-hand circular polarization. Something was amiss, but it was like a nerve-wracking 1 minute of me going like repeating the call a couple times until finally like the strength was strong enough to get through. So we started like putting students through to ask questions. And then I looked over at this little switch, like, I should just try changing the polarization. And I flipped the switch and crystal clear. Like,
oh, wow.
Jeez. Okay. Well, let's just keep going.
All right.
And it was cool because, like, we were all over the news and the front.
But that was still kind of analog, though, right?
Oh, it was all analog.
Yeah.
All analog.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Just radio waves.
Yeah. I mean, we used to go and using the HF radio, we used to like talk to people in other countries and it would bounce through the ionosphere and go all the way around the world. And, you know, I'd be sitting there at the high school talking to somebody in Japan.
Yeah. Through a radio wave.
Through a radio wave. Yeah.
It was amazing. That's incredible. When I was in, at Rice, this is long, long ago. This is the early days of internet and web and stuff like that. Maybe like 2 years past HTML, you know, like that
right.
And there was something that was like, I don't remember what the app was, but it was the early days of Skype, but it wasn't really an app. It was something experimental that someone had put in. I was like, I'm going to try this. And I launched it. And those days, because there were so few people that did that, it just pretty much put whoever is on in the world on there, as opposed to, you know, a million
all
people.
All 7 of you, yeah.
Yeah. I think there was like maybe 25.
Right.
And so I just clicked on a name and just, you didn't even dial. You just started talking and the speaker would go into the other person. Like it wasn't like a phone call. It was literally like
direct connection.
And I was just talking to this guy and I was like, and he goes, hello. And he had this strange Australian accent, right? And then I was like, oh, what? And then this is when I was in architecture school, and someone walked into the school and said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm talking to this guy in Australia. And it's like, what? And they didn't believe me. And they started just saying like, hello. And they were just doing just stupid things. And I was like, no, you're talking to a real person. It's like, no way. It's like, yes. Yeah. But you were doing it over radio.
Right. But still, I think that's pretty cool over early data link.
Yeah.
I mean, they've been using radios for a long time, but like the early days of data.
So Contact must have been a pretty cool movie for you, huh?
Oh, yeah.
That was really cool.
Yeah, seeing her turn on the old amateur radio gear at the beginning was like, oh, I remember that stuff.
Yeah. That's awesome.
But what's funny, like a couple of years ago, I went and I looked, because I haven't done that stuff in a long time, and I looked at the radios and I was like, you know what? They have not updated any of this stuff. Like they have not updated the radios to interface with phones or like the, like there's very little like advancement. There are advances with some digital stuff here and there.
Okay.
But we had some of that digital stuff back then too. And I don't know. It's just weird that they haven't I figured I'd be able to go and get a little brick that I could use that goes right to my phone that I could use amateur radio from my phone data link to a brick that I can have on the top of my car that like would be super high tech version of ham radio, but it's ham radio stayed the same. It's pretty funny.
Do you think there's a physical, like you can't shrink that stuff down or
no.
They never thought about shrinking it down?
No, they should. I mean, HF, maybe some of the lower, you know, like you need certain amp, you know, you need things, but.
Yeah. Doesn't the antenna have to be a certain size?
Depends on the frequency range. There's frequencies that they can miniaturize that stuff, no problem.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah.
But I guess there's no incentive to, right?
No, there's no market for it. There's no incentive. Basically, most of amateur radio, it's all like old retired engineers and
Right.
You know, aerospace engineers or
right,
something.
Right, 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 right. Yeah, and every now and then you'll drive around the neighborhood and you'll see some guy with this massive
giant
antenna.
60-foot antenna right. up there. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And you're like, okay, what's that going on?
I was yeah.
like, obviously.
Yeah. I'll see those and I'm like, all right, cool, cool.
Yeah,
I know stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So that's what's you got into that. And then you said as a graduation person, you got a...
I got a camera. I got an old Rebel X film camera.
Okay.
Back in the day. And I started taking pictures and I was like, this is cool.
And but you never had a camera before that.
I didn't have a camera up until graduating high school. I mean, I went to Hawaii with the family like a couple of years before I graduated. My brother was the official trip photographer. I didn't take any pictures.
Interesting.
But then I got the camera. Uh-huh. And there was just no going back.
Right.
And I went to community college because my grades sucked. And
really?
Yeah.
You know, with all the amateur radio stuff?
Yeah.
I guess you had a different interest, right?
Yeah. No, I had no interest in doing good schoolwork.
Good schoolwork. Yeah. Yeah, yeah,
no,
yeah.
No.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I went and took photo classes and then I was considering going into like a 4-year photo school. And I was just like, you know, I'm not going to pay a bunch of money for somebody to tell me how to take pictures.
Yeah.
And then I realized I wanted to combine the digital, like the technical and the creative, and I found, like, you know, this was after several years of community college, and I was shooting a good amount by then, but
yeah, right.
I went to art school for digital media. So
okay, so you were in community college, but then you went to art school after that.
Yeah.
Where did you go to art school?
Otis.
At Otis. Oh yeah, it's a good school.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
And okay, and then you've focus mainly on photography, or you started doing digital work there too?
I mean, I went all over the place there. I was in the digital media program, but mm-hmm. I was like at one point considering typography, motion graphics, sure. all over. But then I was like, you know, I had already been doing like Photoshop stuff, like actually going way back to, but maybe a couple of years after I got my camera, I was doing, you know, those cell site towers that look like palm trees?
Yes.
So when they first started those in the late 90s,
uh-huh.
I was doing photo simulations for some of the early guys that were submitting those to county planning commissions
uh-huh.
to get them to sign off on them.
Oh, and so it's like a rendering.
But it was all Photoshop hackery.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd go out there, I'd photograph, but I'd take measurements and do a site survey.
Right.
And so I can get at the right height, the right, you know, everything. And they'd show them to the planning commission to get them to say, yeah, okay, well, that's not too much of a eyesore in the neighborhood or whatever.
Right, you know? Right, right.
It's better than a big honking tower.
Right.
So.
It's funny when you see those because they're kind of obvious.
They are. But you know what? Sort of like with a lot of movie effects. Like it's obvious to us. We have a good eye. Most people, you don't even give it a second thought.
Really?
They don't even look at the world around them.
That's interesting. Because, yeah, there's the other ones that look like kind of like...
There's palm trees.
And then there's like some kind of pine trees.
Yeah, there's palm trees. There's cacti. There's one that I did that's out on the 210 heading out towards the Inland Empire. It's a giant cross that's behind a church. But the cross is a cell site. And it's fiberglass. Inside the giant cross are cell antennas.
I can't believe that.
And the church
that.
Makes money every month for having this giant cross that's a cell site in their backyard.
Wow.
It's right over the freeway.
Amazing.
I can't remember which off-ramp it's by, but
amazing.
It's way out there.
Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, there's all sorts of secret ones you'd never know. There's a lot of building facades that are built up that have cell site, cell antennas in them. And yeah.
Might as well make some money off the blood of Christ, right?
Yeah, right. Populate all that data.
Oh my God.
Somebody's got to stream their
stupid
games or whatever.
Yeah. No, okay. That's amazing. Okay. Well, do you get that job while you were at Otis, you said?
No. That was a long time before. That was, when I was way back in the Inland Empire before.
Right. Okay. So when you decided it's like, oh, the camera's kind of changed your life a little bit or changed your point of view, right?
Oh, yeah. I see everything through a lens, yeah.
Now you see everything through a lens, right? Yeah.
Right.
And that's actually really how, I mean, when we should mention the first time I met you was, you know, half a block from here.
Yes.
when you and I were both at Sway, and I believe you were friends with Daniel Buck.
Well, do you know how I got the job? It wasn't that I had worked with anybody at the studio before.
Uh-huh.
Daniel actually was on this automotive photography forum.
Right.
And
you told me about that.
I was on there too. I was photographing this American Le Mans series. Like I was doing on the side professional motorsports photography.
Mm-hmm.
And I go out these races and shoot credentials. And a lot of the other credentialed, like, professional photographers were on there. And then here's Daniel with his Mustang, but he's like doing all this really cool, intricate, like the shallow depth of field stitching, or all this cool stuff that he's doing. And he's posting on there. And I, you know, I see his stuff, I see his local, and I start looking closer at like it has his job on there or something. I'm like, oh, he works in visual effects too. I need to talk to this guy. Mm-hmm. And so I reached out, we started talking. And then, like, I think I ended a job somewhere, and I was looking, hey, will you guys need anybody over there? And he's like, yeah, let me see what I can do. And he brings me in.
Yeah, yeah. That's, I mean, that was a thing to me is I'd gone into CG and done CG work for a long time, but I never really put the connection between CG and photography until probably 2 years into grad school, when I started taking a photography class and started realizing, oh, I really need to know this stuff, right? And I'll be frank with you, and it's embarrassing, but when someone says, you know, what's the f-stop on that lens, I didn't realize that that number was the lowest f-stop that it goes until much later.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Right. So like, oh, okay. So like, I really learned, like, and the whole point of the low f-stop is how big does the aperture get?
Right.
And
the,
like,
inverse.
The inverse. Yeah. Like, and then understanding all that, it's like, okay, now I understand.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. So then I got it. So I finally understood it and I really got into it. And, I started there and I didn't know much about doing car VFX at all.
Right.
I knew a lot about VFX, but I didn't know much about car stuff. But I already knew the connection between car and, between VFX and photography, and all I needed to do is to find someone who knew a lot about photography of cars.
Right.
And therefore I could learn that. And so that automatically became Daniel Buck.
Yes.
For me, right? And so when Daniel came on board, and, you know, well, Daniel was there already, but when Daniel was there and I learned from him, and then he said, Aaron Kupferman, and then he's like, then I was like, oh, Aaron is just like Daniel. He knows a whole lot about car photography and visual effects.
Right.
And that became like a thing that we do. And he did a lot of weird experimental stuff.
Oh yeah. It was great. He was great with that. And just like all his large format, 8x10, 4x5.
Yeah.
Film stuff.
Do you remember when he bought all those huge, large, he's gotten rid of almost all of them.
Yeah, he has. It's a shame. But
I think it was a phase for him.
It was a phase, but I enjoyed living vicariously through him with that stuff.
I know. Remember when we waited for like 3 months for him to get that Chinese 8x10. Do you remember that one?
I vaguely, yeah.
It was like this huge 8x10 large format camera that he was going to buy.
Because it was never practical for me. And
it wasn't for him either.
For him either. But the fact that he was doing it, I was able to geek out with him on that stuff. And that's why I enjoyed it.
Yeah. But you were also really, you were a fan. No matter what Daniel knew about photography, which was a lot, you always knew more. And I think he always relied on you to help him.
He had his stuff. I back when I was in art school, I also worked at a, one of the top LA photo labs.
Okay.
As like a, I guess I was technical supervisor, but like a technical person there doing a lot of equipment calibration. It was A&I. Mm-hmm. And at the time they were one of the top, like if you sent your film into B&H for a mailer developer, it would go there. They had a giant developing setup. They did prints that went into like fine art galleries, commercial stuff, like all over. And I did printing with them. And I did like calibrations with them, and I did, and there were so many of the people that were there were also photographers.
Right.
So I learned also how to shoot. I never really learned how to shoot large format there, but I learned medium format, and I rented medium format gear all the time. I shot a lot of 6.45, 6.7, 6.12,
right,
and all that stuff. And I really got into that. And I went quite a long time before I switched over to digital. Because I was still involved in the medium format film. And I mean, when I was working there, I got film for half off and I got developing for free.
Right.
It was great.
Yeah.
You know, I could go and shoot 30 rolls of medium format and it wouldn't cost me much at all.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it was interesting, especially when Daniel was starting to get into some of the medium format stuff as well.
Yeah.
I started to get interested in that. And he also used to buy those weird lenses he would get from like Russian
sun, yes.
Like, you know,
I'm sure he has radioactive scars from that stuff still to this
yeah,
day.
Yeah, and when you
they're wacky.
We're not joking when we say there some of them were like illegal because they had
they really were radioactive.
Radioactive lenses on them. I think he got one of them from a spy camera from World War II that was mounted on the bottom of a spy plane.
Yes.
It was huge.
I remember he used his hat as a shutter.
He did.
Yes. He put his hat over it. He turned the light on in the room.
Because it didn't have a shutter. Right.
For like a second or two, then put the hat back on real quick.
Right.
And it was great.
Yeah. And why not experiment with that? And he would do it digitally too.
Yeah.
Like he would find a way to like, you know, duct tape this thing to a digital camera.
Yes.
Which is amazing. And there was a lot of fun stuff. I mean, remember you and I like trying to like figure out all of these weird things that he was doing. By the way, I saw there was an article recently just made me think of like what you and I and Daniel were thinking about back then. They're back on an old Nintendo DS, like those Game Boy type things.
Mm-hmm.
There used to be a camera module that you could get on there that would make literally like a like a two-tone,
right.
like literally black or white LCD image.
That Yeah.
Figured out how to mount a... The lens that you had, the Canon 70 to 200
the big 70 to 200 yeah,
mounted this onto the
thing.
Game Boy
That's
and
hilarious.
Took a picture with it, and it looks amazing. It's amazing, but there was weird stuff that we were doing, and I think that I remember specifically that I learned a lot about lensing and about coding and stuff through you and through Daniel. That really advanced my views of photography, which was so critical to CG.
Yes.
So what I want to know from you, and I'd love you to help people who are listening to the podcast, to tell them why it's so important to know about photography and why that plays such a role in CG.
I think that I guess you could first of all look at composition of training the eye to be able to find a good composition. I mean, in the real world, in the CG world, you can do anything with the camera. Obviously, you're limited more in the real world. In the CG world, you can do anything. But, you know, you can...
Do you think that's actually an advantage or a disadvantage? Because sometimes I feel that limiting can actually...
Constraints can help, but I think that Once you can overcome the freedom to do anything, you can then do what you want to make it look better.
Okay.
If you go and I can do anything, I'm going to do everything. No.
Mm-hmm.
But so yes, like I'll go somewhere and I'll shoot for a day with one focal length, with one lens, a prime lens.
Right.
And I enjoy that. And that's a constraint that I place upon myself. But I don't need that constraint. I could go out with any focal length and I can still, you know, be focused enough, but to be able to think about what I want and not think about everything and anything.
Mm-hmm.
But separate from that, I mean, well, I think once you can get past the point of being able to control yourself with unlimited possibilities, you know, you need to really get into composition and thinking about how you're going to frame what you're doing. And, you know, I think the biggest thing that I see people who are more amateur into image making and composition compared to professionals, it's not about where in the image I place the subject. It's about the edges.
Explain that.
So if you have something that's sort of awkwardly hanging out right on the edge of an image,
uh-huh.
Or it's like the person's like you're doing a portrait of somebody and their head has just enough headroom, but their toes are like touching the bottom of the frame. You know, it's awkward. It's like, are they in or are they out? You can use that as a way to set an image like on edge to have an awkward feeling. And that's mm-hmm. something that could be utilized in a composition, but usually it's not pleasant.
But do you think the unpleasantness is good or
no? That's what I'm saying. It can be used. You can create an image intentionally for it to be unpleasant or awkward, but that isn't usually most people's intention.
Because, like, for example, okay, let's use this as another example, and maybe you can tell me this is a different situation, which is when Dan Thrawn likes to shoot short films, right? And so one mm-hmm. of the ways he likes to shoot things, if he's doing a dialogue shot like you and I, right, he would shoot from over my shoulder, but he would have me just a little out of focus. So I'm kind of dirty in the frame, right?
Right, right.
But that implies that there's a person there that you're looking at. So you can sort of see that.
But what if there wasn't enough that you could tell it was you? It was just a blurry side of an earphone hanging out a fraction into the edge of the image.
Right, just like the very edge.
Just on the edge, and that's distracting. Right. Or like a photographer that I knew posted something that was this amazing shot of like some really beautiful waves of sand on some dunes. And in the bottom corner, he happened to have this little twig that was just barely sticking in, but it wasn't quite in. It wasn't part of the composition, but it was there. And like these beautiful dunes were going on. And I reached out to him. I was like, hey, you know, what if you crop this just a tiny, tiny bit more? Right. You crop out that little stick, and the composition is nice and clean and pure and night. You know, like there's no other distraction. And he was like, "Holy crap! That's like I didn't even think about that.
You didn't even
he didn't even see it. But when I looked at it, like that's all my eye went to.
Right.
And I mean, everyone makes mistakes like that. But it's just about like really thinking about your edges, like what is in and what is not, and what is cleanly part of the composition and what shouldn't be in the image at all.
Right. Right.
And walking around with a camera and a lens, a prime lens, and just thinking about that when you're pointing it at things, it's a really great exercise.
Do you think
that
people
could translate into creating cameras in the computer?
But this is a skill that people can do today.
Oh, and right. Yeah, on their iPhones. And you don't need a fancy camera. Exactly. Your iPhone is a prime lens.
Perfect. That's exactly what I'm getting at. People have that tool right in their pocket.
Yes.
And it's not just about selfies and about their dinner. It's about other things, cars.
It's about thinking about what's in your image and how you're framing it and the edges, because that defines what's in or is not in the image.
You know, it's interesting also because I've seen, you know, obviously you can get your default camera app on your iPhone or whatever, but there's other camera apps that you can get that are the quote unquote professional camera apps, right?
I've tried a few of those. I just use the default. Yeah.
Right. And they're not necessarily better in any way.
They might give you a few controls.
But what they do on some of them is they offer guides. So they give you the two-thirds guide.
Mm-hmm.
And to you and I, you know, or to a lot of people who do photography, we don't need those guides.
Right.
But if you've never had them, it's not a bad place to start.
It isn't. But as I said, to me, it isn't as much about, yes, the rule of thirds is a good thing to follow in most cases. It's nice. It can help you lay out a more pleasant feeling composition.
Mm-hmm.
And you should get used to doing that unless you want to break it specifically center. You know, if you want to put something center or you want to have something symmetrical in some way. But if you do rule of thirds and then you have this awkward little part of their knee that's sort of half in and half out the mm-hmm. edge of the image, it's not clean. It's not a nice frame mm-hmm. as a whole. It's not as much about where something is in the middle, you know, a fraction here, a fraction there to the side. That's what, you know, doesn't matter. It's if it's a fraction to the side, but you're cropping out something that isn't messy, or if there is something, you can include it all the way and not have a sphere with the edge touching the edge of frame.
Mm-hmm.
You can include it all the way, or you can crop it off. Be decisive with every edge. It's about being decisive.
So you think that the first skill that people need to learn in terms of any kind of stuff is composition?
I think so, because, you know, yes, the technical stuff, is it in focus? Is it not in focus? Is it exposed? Is it not? That's really not that hard to learn. That's just
interesting.
That's just a technical thing, such as just learning how to use the basic tools of a renderer. But
sure.
But you know, you can do tutorials, but what you can't get from tutorials is how to create a good composition. You have to go and do that. You have to go and shoot. You have to spend a lot of time shooting walking around. You know, one of the exercises we did in art school is you get one of those empty, I know it's impossible to find now, those 35 millimeter slide
The boxes.
Holders.
Yeah, and you make a pinhole out of it.
No. You just take the empty, just a single frame of a slide, take this the film out, and hold it up to your eye.
Oh,
and
I see.
And you can just walk around, and you can frame things, and you can pretend like it's your little like box of composition.
Right.
And we did that with still life.
Now you just do it with your camera.
You can do it with your camera. But, you know, to remove all of the distractions, you could use, just take a piece of cardboard, cut out a 16:9 square, and walk around. And you'll look silly, maybe do it in the privacy of your own living room, but walk around framing things. And that way you're removing exposure, focus,
I mean, that's
that
what
stuff.
Directors used to do, right?
Yeah, you hold your fingers up.
Two fingers up. I'm just doing the act. We'd put one hand up with your thumb to the side and the other hand on top with the other thumb to the side, and you basically make a frame. And you used to see that. And
should I take a picture of you doing that and you can post it to the...
No.
No, okay.
No, don't do that, Aaron.
Yeah.
But that is, I think that that's really an important thing as composition. Now... let's say you're a lighting artist and you have no control over composition because it was already shot.
Camera set, yes.
Right?
Yes.
Camera set, right? At the same time, there's a lot of information. And I know you said that, you know, you can learn that on the fly, but I think there's still a lot that people could learn from just the technology of cameras that is important part of the rendering process. It's not just about rendering. It's like, know what focus is, know what, understand the difference what f-stop does and what camera speed does and all those
right,
things.
Right. And granted, some of that stuff is more on the compositing side than the lighting side.
No, but I think it still should be
but
on the lighting
it
side.
It is on the lighting side.
Because,
but as far
because the lighting is, especially in ray tracing, it's that's as close to a simulation of a camera as we got.
Right, right. So then I guess you could say go get a couple of light kits with some softboxes, and they can be the cheap $80 ones on Amazon.
Right.
And instead of like learning how to light by moving these infinitely variable lights around in your computer,
right,
go and, you know, move them around your living room.
Yeah.
And get some physical lights and actually learn like figure out how to light stuff physically. And learn how to light before you learn how to CG light.
You can literally just take a, if you have no money.
Yes.
You can take a flashlight, some cardboard, and some wax paper.
A desk lamp,
A desk lamp,
and you can cut out a piece of fabric or an 8.5 by 11 sheet of white paper.
Right.
And you can hang that right in front of the desk lamp, and that's your soft.
Right.
And you can shoot some light through that, and then you can go and, yeah, I mean, you can... You can hack together whatever kind of lighting kit, but play with real lights and play with the real camera and sort of learn how the light reacts.
Yeah. I think what people don't realize, especially when they're in CG, is they think they need 5 lights to light a scene.
Right.
And the hardest thing is to realize the correct lighting can come from one light.
One or two or
Yeah.
I mean, what traditionally most photo shoots would have 2, maybe 3 a rim,
right?
But max 3. You never would really go with more than 3.
Yeah, and 3 is like,
I mean, you have a key, a fill, and a rim.
Yeah,
I mean, that's like the traditional 3, and you can set up almost anything you want with that.
Right, but even I was talking about it with Ian Spriggs. You can do, you know, when Rembrandt was lighting for his paintings,
yes,
he used one light.
You look at those old paintings and they're very
it's single. A window light, right?
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah.
And it still looked beautiful. So that's, I think, an important part of the whole learning process is like, how do you compose with your lighting as well?
Right.
Things don't need to be, I think sometimes because computers, especially CG, offers so many tools, sometimes people think that they need to use all those tools, right?
Yeah.
It's like, before you took a photograph, you would go into your menu of your camera and change every setting of every submenu on your camera before you took the picture. That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Well, it's funny is I rarely ever use lighting in my photography. I shoot almost exclusively found light.
And
I only just recently bought a couple of softbox lights that I could use because I'm – like I do a lot of woodworking and I have an Instagram account and I'm taking pictures of stuff and mm-hmm. I want to have some nice soft lighting that I can move around and like, you know, like I just got lights for that. But mm-hmm. aside from that, I've really never owned lights in the history of my photography.
Right. Now, granted, okay, I'm going to, I just saw just this weekend you went to a car show.
Yes.
In Beverly Hills.
The Father's Day, yeah.
Father's Day car show.
Concorde Elegance.
Which is beautiful cars, by the way.
Yeah,
amazing. I love that show. Cars.
You'll see Jay Leno there sometimes. Yeah.
Yes. And yeah, Jay comes down in that area. And you took some incredible photographs. And you joked about it as like, well, I took whatever photographs I could take considering I was hanging out with my two kids. And
yeah, I mean, I literally had one kid on my hand at all times.
Right.
And then I'm trying to like reach over with my camera, focus and compose and well, you know, with the other hand.
It still came out amazing.
Well, I did some cropping. And
you did some cropping and you did some things. I'm sure you took
cleaned up my compositions.
I'm sure you took out, you threw away a lot of photos.
Yeah.
But nonetheless,
30 or so.
You're able to get 30 beautiful photographs of cars.
Yeah.
Right? Under those conditions.
Right.
So restricted time of composition because you have a kid on your arm.
Yeah.
Right?
Two-year-old.
You're using existing lighting because fuck it, I don't have time.
Yeah, no. Yeah, right. Well, yeah. You're at a car show. You can't do anything with lighting.
Right. And it's still like these. Now, also, you had beautiful subjects.
Yeah.
You had some really amazing cars, which is another thing I want to bring up is cars. Car photography is a very different kind of passion.
It is. Well, the studio level car photography is something I would not be able to touch at all. That's like super, super detail.
Very
really hard to light. That stuff I wouldn't even be able to approach like touching. I've always done
existing lighting, right?
Existing lighting but even some of the like static shots you'll see of cars that look like existing lighting, you know, they have lights in there.
Now before we go on, before people say, not really interested in car lighting. The concept of car lighting actually applies to a bigger, a big range of things, including product marketing.
Right.
Any kind of, you know, if you're going to design a spaceship, you would use the same concept as car lighting, right?
Yes, but cars are, as you know, from lighting them in CG, they're specifically reflective in unique ways that you need to show it in unique ways.
Right.
And so, yes, I mean, you do. It is similar to product photography, but mm-hmm. it's not. It is unique.
Yes, but there's a lot of things that can happen. There's something special about car photography.
Yes,
and I didn't know that until I started this way, honestly, and met you and Daniel. Just things like, how do you get that line of light right over the edge of the car?
Right.
How do you like how important headlights are? Headlights are.
Yeah,
so critical to the soul of the car, and cars do have souls. That's why you know.
Well, they have faces.
They have faces.
Yeah.
Yeah. So tell me about the face of the car.
There are just look up some of the older MGs, and you'll see some fun faces. But
right.
No, I mean honestly, I've mostly shot motorsports, car racing,
right,
and cars moving. And
right, which is really hard.
That's very, very niche. And honestly, most people that shoot car photography, they use way too fast of a shutter speed and they freeze the car and it looks like it's parked on the racetrack.
Right.
And a lot of the people that are shooting, you know, the not the primo people, but like the mid-range, pretty decent motorsports photographers are still freezing cars on the track. And granted, there are a lot of times when you should do that when the car is in a dynamic situation, you're freezing it in the dynamic situation. Mm-hmm. So you're seeing it do something, mm-hmm. but usually just a car going around a turn frozen in that turn, it's parked. Yeah. Maybe the suspension is a bit compressed, but it's parked.
Right.
And so
if you're using like a thousandth of a second.
Yeah. 1,000, 5,000th of a second, you have your ISO cranked way up so you can get like, you know, 5,000th of a second freezing that thing because mm-hmm. that's, you know, and also you're cropped right on the car and you can't see the context or mm-hmm. it's not a photograph of that's pleasing. It's just a documentation of the car. Mm-hmm. I mean, I got into panning and panning.
That's gotta be tough.
Really what makes it beautiful for me is capturing the motion and shooting like a 500 millimeter lens at 40th of a second. And the
How the hell do you do that?
And the car, I mean, granted,
muscle memory.
Yeah, muscle memory. And you're standing there at a turn, and I mean, you have the lens on a monopod.
Okay. So that helps.
Well, that's critical. You can't do it. Yeah, no, you can't handhold a 500 F4 Canon. No.
Yeah.
But, you know, as the cars turn in, you sort of get used to the flow of them through a turn, and you sort of move your whole upper torso. It's more like your legs and your torso is moving the lens, and your arms and your shoulders are staying locked to the camera and the lens.
Wow.
And you're moving your whole body following this thing.
Right.
And you just follow it through. And then you have to track the right part of the car through the turn, or you'll get the tail of the car sharp, but the nose will be blurry because you're not panning fast enough with the nose.
Because sometimes the nose could be moving at a different rate.
In pure frozen, like, if you take that moment, the car is actually rotating in relationship to the camera.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were to remove its translation, the car is just sitting there rotating.
Right.
And you need to move the car move the lens and the camera, not only with the car, but with the part of the car that you want to be non-motion blurred.
Right.
And so that takes a lot of muscle memory to build up.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed that, and I did a lot of that.
Yeah, And we definitely, I mean, if with your permission, we'd love to put some of your pictures on the blog post so that people can get ideas that we're talking about. So if you're listening to this, go back to the actual CG Garage page and look at some of his photography to do that. But I want to bring up something else as an example.
Yes.
Because I remember this specifically. We were talking about this at Sway, the act of panning during a shot and the technology of cameras. And we remembered the old... rolling shutter images, the old rolling shutter images, right? From like the 1920s or whatever. And when they panned with the car to take the photograph, the shutter would roll down. And so the top of the wheel would look like it was in front of the back of the wheel.
Right. I'm trying to remember what exactly that shutter, that type of
Daniel knows that
type of shutter is called, but yes, it slides down. It's like a slit scan.
It's a rolling shutter,
right?
It's like a slit scan, right?
Yeah.
And then you would use this shutter to basically expose as it goes down, and you would just have it lower. And so those old cartoons of cars going really fast down the tracks would have these oblong, weird shaped tires.
Yeah.
To mimic that rolling shutter
camera
stuff.
Maybe it started the style of cartoon cars.
Yeah, the cartoon cars, I think that was.
That's funny. Yeah, Daniel took one of his 8x10s out to the track because my dad races vintage cars.
Yeah.
And he was doing a race out at Auto Club Speedway out in Fontana.
Yeah, doesn't your dad race old Porsches or something?
He had a couple of Porsches. He has a different one now. It's, God, I'm blanking on the name. But... he's had a lot over the years. He has one, and then he sells it after a couple of years, and he has another one. Mm-hmm. Just trying all these different cars for fun because it's fun. He doesn't have the money to keep them all. I wish I could have them all eventually, but no. He just rotates through cars. But we went out with the 8x10, and I got permission for Daniel to shoot the 8x10 trackside, and he got some cool shots.
Yeah, like, it was hard though.
Oh yeah, it was very hard.
It's a challenge.
He wasn't going to try to pan with the cars with that. That wasn't going to happen. But
yeah,
it was fun. It was fun.
But I think that's an important thing because it's interesting. I remember specifically thinking about studio lighting of cars because when we were at Sway, we used to do a lot of beauty shots of cars,
right?
And that's all studio lighting. But it's cheaper to do it in CG, because we don't we don't have to buy an 80-foot Fisher light
to do something. Whole stage for
doing existing lighting was also interesting too. That's very interesting. So do you think that cars, what is your favorite subject to shoot?
Oh, definitely. Well, it's cars, but I also do the nighttime time lapse.
Yes.
I have my time lapse stuff, and I've gotten into that over the last couple of years to the point where I'll go out somewhere and I'll only shoot time lapse and I won't shoot one still photo sometimes.
So I
have a couple of motion control rigs.
Uh-huh.
Some are sort of DIY and some, like one of which it's a dynamic perception motion rig, which it's 100 inches of travel with pan and tilt. and I can set this up. And I have three Sony cameras, two A7Ss and one A7R. Mm. And I still have my old Canon 1DX. And right. So I'll set up all four cameras, and I'll go somewhere for 24, you know, with kids, I can only maybe get away for 24 hours.
Right.
So I'll literally drive up to Death Valley, like, you know, six hours, get there, set up, start rolling all my cameras, motion control, time lapse. And I have some panning time lapse and all this stuff. And, you know, 18 hours later, I'll say, all right, I'm done. And I'll drive back to LA and I'll right. jump back into parent, you know, mode. But
sure.
I mean, I do a lot of the stuff with the Milky Way going overhead, or like I've tried adding lights to the scene in front of the camera, like little tiny spot, like tiny, tiny little button lights inside of bushes, and have the camera like, and that are hopefully at the same luminance as the Milky Way. Right. And so I'll have like this lit up really cool like landscape ahead of me with the Milky Way then going over it. And I've tried that a few times. It's a little cheesy, but it's pretty cool. But most of it's very natural, like out in the middle of nowhere.
But it sounds exactly like what you were doing with your ham radio. You just got all this weird technology, and you're going to try to use all that to make something really beautiful.
Yeah.
You know?
It's fun.
Yeah. Yeah. But the biggest concern I always had about time-lapse motion control is beyond what I can do with time-lapse right now. But is battery life. How do you deal with
it? I have some big... Goal Zero, like beefy batteries, like the size of a car battery. And I've rigged up some wiring harnesses so I can run all my cameras and the motion control rigs all off these big batteries.
Okay.
So I can run for days at a time with no power issue.
Interesting.
And I just have to lug all this stuff out there. So I really haven't been able to do much backpacking. I have a 4x4 now. You know, once the kids came along, I sold the sports cars and I had to get something. I was like, all right, I'll get a 4x4.
Yeah.
And so I'll drive way out in the middle of nowhere now. And I'll go out with Kurt Lawson and go with Zach Mant and, you know,
two great guys.
Folks. Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
They're great guys. And, and so I'll go out with them and some other folks and we'll go out and shoot some stuff. I went out with Zach up to this really cool spot up in the Sierras.
I should get Zach on this podcast.
Oh, he'd be great.
Yeah. He'd be cool.
You might have to have a beep button.
That's fine. No, we can.
I mean, you're not. Well,
I won't put the explicit rating on our podcast, but with Zach, I think
for Zach's, yeah, you would need that. Yes, yes.
It's like with Tim Miller, it was almost impossible. But yeah, no, there was. It's. I think there's something really kind of cool about all you photography guys that really sort of exchange your ideas and stuff, especially those who have a little bit of a technology thing going behind them too.
Yeah, Zach's got that.
Which you do, because I think that kind of lets you geek out and have a little bit of fun.
Right.
There's a little bit of fun to geeking out about photography.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Photography is an aesthetic.
But I will 100% say that, you know, it's, I have a saying, like, it's not about the gear, it's about what you do with it. And you know, it's like, you go to a restaurant, it's like, this tastes amazing. What type of pots did you use?
Yeah, that's bullshit.
You know, like, That is probably one of my biggest pet peeves is somebody sees my photos and like, God, that looks great. What camera did you use?
Right.
Yeah. Oh, well, I guess it doesn't matter what I did with it. You know?
No. I remember very specifically on Stealth, there was an amazing artist. Her name was Lynn Bassas, and she did some incredible lighting on one of the shots of this plane. It's a terrible movie. Don't watch the movie necessarily. But it was you know, CG plane landing on an aircraft carrier. And it was so beautifully integrated. It was like perfect. And anyone said, wow, the lighting is so good. What HDR did you use? And I just said, that's the most insulting thing you could ever think. It's like
this, like to an artist, like, what pencils do you use to draw that? That looks great.
Yeah. Is that oil painting or watercolor?
Well, let me see these brushes.
Yeah.
Must be something magical about the brushes.
Yeah. No, it's not about that. You're right. And it's not about the gear. It's about what you do with it. But it's fun to geek out about the gear.
It's fun to have the gear geeking out aspect.
Right.
For sure.
Because I think, you know, what it does a little bit. Let's say you take your photography, your time-lapse stuff. You can go, I got all this gear. What can I do with it?
Right.
You know, ooh, this will be fun. Let's try this. Let's try that.
Right.
You
know? And also, you know, on the other hand, the gear becomes so fluent with you, it becomes a language.
Right.
That you're not thinking about the gear, that you're thinking about what you want to do with it.
Right.
Yeah. And, but then, you know, it is fun to geek out. And like a couple years ago, I built this literally somebody was talking to me about some 360 video thing they were going to do. And I was like, oh, I've been thinking about making a camera rig for 360 video. And mm-hmm. so I said, I might be able to do something for time lapse. And we ended up like just with a mention of it, my brain like went into engineering mode again. Uh-huh. And I sat down at my computer and just in 3D, I went and built up a rig. And within a month and a half, I think a month, I had a fully functional 3D printed, I have a printer, mm-hmm. Four camera time lapse rig for 360 video that the cameras can fold out so you can access the menus and then fold back in so you could lock it back into the right. Because, you know, a lot of the ones, like, they're so tightly compacted in there, but if you want to remove it, you have to, like, go through a whole ordeal to remove the camera to access the menus in the back.
Right, right.
So I designed a system that like, it's like a flower petal. It opens up.
Right.
And you could access the back of all the cameras and fold it back into detent so it's at the right angle. Mm-hmm. And went out to the Grand Canyon and shot some really cool 360 video with that.
Oh, awesome.
But like going from idea to prototype to like
yeah.
first working beta, like it, but it actually worked.
Yeah.
And got electronics rig set up for it and shot some 360 time lapse like all through the night of the Milky Way going over the Grand Canyon.
Right.
It was pretty cool.
Yeah. That's
like awesome. Within like a month and a half.
That's awesome. That's awesome. But I know we've talked a lot about photography because this is something that I've known a lot about you, and I always come to you about that stuff. You mentioned, that compositing is something that that is heavily involved or should know a lot about photography as well, which to me always seemed a little bit interesting because compositing is a 2D endeavor.
Yeah.
And photography is the act of taking something 3D and turning it into 2D.
Into 2D space,
which is what lighting is, you know?
Right. But lighting can only take it so far through a render.
Or and it can take it all the way.
Well, it yes, could. But
if
but,
I mean,
as far as chromatic, you know,
right.
like dialing the last little bit of it to look like a photograph. Yes, you could put a grain into a render. You can put,
yes,
you know, chromatic aberration and stuff like that. But I think lens distortion, all that, like, you know. But I think just taking it in and dialing it the last bit in compositing really
right.
does.
So that's what I was going to get at. So the compositors are the ones that need to know. They are ultimately the people that are the last person to touch an image.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, we are.
With the exception of a colorist.
Right.
Right. Which, as I know,
they'll screw everything up that we do.
Well,
No.
Well, yeah, that's the thing.
No, sometimes.
That's not the way lighters feel about compositors.
Sometimes. I know, exactly. So that's why I always start off with the light comp.
Right.
Okay, I do that.
So, but that's the point, is that you are the last thing. So in order for something, if a compositor's job is like, whatever doesn't look photoreal, it's my responsibility to make it look photoreal.
Right.
And so compositors really have to know about photography, because that's the thing a lot of people forget.
Yeah.
When people say it looks photoreal,
what is
means
that?
It looks like a photograph.
Right.
And you have to understand what
everything
kind
that
of,
goes into that. Yeah.
And what kind of photography are you actually trying to mimic?
Right.
Because you may be trying to mimic 35mm film. You may be trying to mimic VHS tapes.
On Alison, the first Alice in Wonderland, we got a sequence that was where she was shrunk down.
Mm-hmm.
And I created this whole look that looked a lot more like it was shot through a macro kind of scale of a lens.
Uh-huh.
And a whole treatment for that was, and it worked out very well, that with, it just felt a lot smaller scale through that treatment. The mm-hmm. renders were the same renders.
The same renders.
And it was shot full scale with full scale cameras.
Right.
But, you know, you have to treat it with all the things that, all the tools and ways that a compositor can do things. Like, you
right.
have to treat it to make it feel like it was shot macro.
But you were always, even though you came from photography, you were always interested in the compositing side of things.
Yeah. I mean, when I went to at Otis in my last 2 years, I found compositing mm-hmm. and I really went that direction. And I've always done compositing. I mean, on one movie, on Green Lantern at Sony, I had a little, like I wasn't a lead. I had a little extra time. I was able, like, hey, can I light my own shots? Can I learn katana? And I sat with a lighter and I was able to learn lighting and lit all my own shots and got really heavy into, I didn't just hit render on my lighting scenes. I mean, I really got deep in there.
Right.
I lit all my own shots. It was really educational for me.
Sure, I haven't
lit a show since.
Right.
But it was fun. But no, I've always done compositing and I've always, you know, like to me, Maya is like, what the heck is going on? I can't use Maya.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Welcome to our world.
Yeah, I know. Right. Neither can you. Right. Yeah.
But yeah, I understand what you mean. I think that compositing is also, you know, just been, an interesting part of the world of, that last step. Right.
Yeah.
And if you look at some really good, if I look at some of the guys who really, like, let's look at Daniel Buck, right? He's a very good lighter, right?
Yes.
But he's actually a really good compositor.
He is. He has a good eye for that,
too. He's a really good compositor. He's known for his lighting, but you can actually give him a comp. And
he can final his
shots
beautifully.
And I think that comes from his photography.
Right. I mean, you look at a lot of the people at Sony through the older days, that a lot of people were all doing light comp.
Right.
And there was a lot of overlap, and you were able to
you finally your own shots.
You finally your own shots all the way through. And a lot of those older school Sony people, they did that. Now, there were some people that should have maybe focused just on lighting or just on compositing, and you know, but some of those folks were really good, and they were able to do both.
Right.
And you know, it can be beneficial to do both,
right?
And to know what you want out of both sides, and to just go all the way through with it. And there isn't the overhead of two different people working separately on something.
Right.
You can just do it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a good lesson to learn about the compositing world. And so it's the point I'm trying to make is making that connection between, like, you understand cameras, you understand lighting, and you understand compositing. And if you can actually do that, I think there's a world where you can actually become really good and have a great eye with those three things. And I'm not necessarily dismissing all the, you know, the modeling and the texturing and all that other stuff, because I think those are very valuable.
Yeah, absolutely.
But those are much more of a 3D world, right? Yes. Those are the world of, you know, sculpting and creating all those
things. Unless maybe you're going, you know, into a VR environment where there is no rendering as far as to a frame and then compositing it. And, you know, yes, there is some of that in there, but I mean,
well, that's actually a good point, because I want to bring this up really quickly, because I've actually seen a lot of people that try to take some beautiful short film or whatever and make a VR experience out of it.
No.
There's a problem with this, and the problem is that they're beautifully shot short films and CG, all CG, whatever. They're using photographic techniques that use depth of field, framing, etc. In VR, there is none of that.
No.
It's all first person, no depth of field, no nothing, and just going forward with that.
I went back to Otis to view some of the student work, and somebody showed me a VR thing, and I was looking around, checking out things, and all of a sudden, apparently behind me, a monster came crashing through the wall, but I missed it. I didn't know to go there. And I was like, oh, well, that's great. I didn't see it. Thanks. Right.
There's actually tricks to make that happen now that people are learning that dialogue, because there's ways that you can make that happen.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But when the term photorealism applies to things that are actually mimicking photography, and it should not apply to things like VR, I don't think.
Right. That's an immersive experience.
Right.
Not a cinematic experience.
First person versus third person.
In that as well.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, geez, Aaron, we've already gone over an hour.
I know. How'd that happen?
Do you like that?
Yeah.
All right. So listen, I know you mentioned it. Is there certain things you want to talk about? You said there are some things you want to talk about.
I don't know.
First of all, this is exactly where the conversation I wanted to go and talk about that photography, because I think that photography is so important to
anybody in visual effects.
To anyone doing anything visual.
Anything visual, yeah.
I mean, including painting. You know?
Well, yeah.
You know what I mean? Because it's so immediately gratifying.
Now, I will say, doing photography and learning from photography are two different things, because okay. you can go out and shoot a ton of pictures. I mean, I saw this when I was taking even my early photo classes in community college.
Yeah.
I would take three times as many pictures as everybody else. And, you know, but what I was doing is I was analyzing my pictures. I was looking at what I was doing. I was comparing to other people's work that I was, you know, yeah, maybe trying to mimic, maybe trying to get influence from or whatever. But I was also analyzing my technical, you know, things that I was trying to figure out and learn. Like you can go out and shoot a bunch of stuff on your iPhone. You can play with composition. You can go out and try to learn, you know, the basics of the technical with aperture and shutter speed and all that stuff. But until you sit down, you look at your images and you critique them with a really critical eye, or you even go so far as to have other people go that might have the patience. They need to have the patience, but that have the patience that are willing to go through your work and give you a critique like you would get in a visual effects review session.
Okay.
With completely, like, you need to be able to learn from what you're doing.
Yeah.
You can go and shoot until you're blue in the face and you fill up all your memory cards and your hard drives. Unless you learn from that, it's for naught.
Right. I think that people have a hard time critiquing photography.
Yeah.
It's hard.
And their own work.
And their own work. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
I think that's the most important thing with any type of art or any type of work where you're trying to get better, and it's a subjective getting better. It's not like I'm trying to get better at doing, you know, stock market where I can chart how much I'm getting better based on numbers or whatever. Like getting better at art, that's very subjective, and you need to really have the right mindset going into it and coming out of it to get something out.
What? Yeah. Okay, let's just bring this up. Are you okay with time?
Yeah.
Okay. What do you think about the internet right now in terms of art critique? Because right now, no, I know this is a yeah. big subject, right?
Yeah, I guess that's true. I steer clear of it, but yes, go ahead.
You're please. Right. It's a big subject.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people out there that are creating things, art, and they're good. Uh-huh. Some of them are good. Some of them are not so good, just like everything else, right? But they are putting it out there for validation on the internet.
Right.
For likes.
Yes.
Right? How many likes did I get? How many "that looks awesome" comments did I get? How many shares did I get? Whatever.
I have stopped posting to any of those places that just are, hey, great shot kind of places. And there's a lot of photography forums, and it's not worth it. I'd rather just post to my Facebook page or my website, where if people want to go and enjoy my work, they can. Okay. And that's great. And if they give me some nice comments, that's great. I enjoy hearing what people think. And if somebody says something
But Aaron, you and I are older.
I know. Right?
We don't necessarily need that validation.
Right.
And I don't mean to say that, you know, younger people do and older people don't. Because some older people do need validation and some younger people don't.
Yeah.
But I think that you're more likely to be more secure in your skin as you're older and less than when you're younger.
Sure.
And by the way, being insecure is actually a great thing because that's what makes you want to improve yourself, right?
Right.
But what do you think about the effect of that like me, then how does that affect the quality of your work?
Of a person's work, emotionally speaking,
or the actual quality of their work.
Well, I think that there are a lot of artificial things that cause people to, if you show 8 images to a group of people, there are a lot of artificial things in an image that might cause the eye to immediately go to some images over others. Mm-hmm. Saturation, contrast, mm-hmm. a single subject as opposed to a more complicated multi-subject composition. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's such a limited screen space versus eye space, and there's so many images out there and people looking at images, and, you know, what is going, like, the standard of what might be considered a good image to the populace, maybe it's changing because the attention span of somebody to look at an image that's a complex, you know, intricate composition with a lot of beautiful things going on inside of it, nobody's going to sit and look at that anymore.
Right.
Not to say that that isn't good. It is good and it's beautiful, but it may not have, it may not work on the internet.
Right.
And maybe it has a different setting.
You know, it's interesting. There was a research, I think it was at Stanford. It's either Stanford or UC Berkeley. But it was doing a psychology experiment about listening to music and with different age groups.
Okay.
And they found that older people were more likely to find music that was uncompressed pleasing.
Right.
And old and younger people that found compressed radio, MP3 music to be more pleasing.
Because compressed meaning the range of the music, not the, to clarify.
MP3s.
Oh, you mean MP3 compression? I thought you
MP3
meant like,
compression.
Like dynamic range, MP, like for radio play compression.
No. Okay. MP3 compression versus,
oh, geez, really?
Versus FLAC, right? So like uncompressed audio was older people like, yeah, that's better audio.
Right.
And then the younger people like, no, that's better audio because they got so used to, lossy compression on audio.
I would have never thought that that would be something to compare, but I thought you were talking dynamic range compression like they do for radio.
Nope.
But that's crazy.
Yeah. The younger people.
MP3 compression was
MP3
more.
Compression, you know, it does muffle certain sounds.
Sure,
it doesn't necessarily muffle the dynamic range, like you mentioned.
But it does clip some stuff.
It clips a few things. Your cymbals are not as rich because there's not enough, you know,
the high range,
and all that other stuff. So it's, yes. And it's interesting, right? To think about.
I wonder
about
if you did that with like JPEGs versus TIFFs or like heavy MP4 compression.
Right.
Something.
Well, I don't know. I mean, now everyone's going higher dynamic.
Yeah.
You know, like that's becoming a thing. Like, you know, the quality of images that are on your TV compared to when you and I were kids.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
You know, CRT tubes.
I go back to some old shows that I did in 720.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Did I really work on that few pixels?
Yeah, I know.
By 480? Only 480 tall? What?
Yeah, I know.
That's nothing.
Yeah, I know. I know. And now everything's 4K HDR.
Yeah.
And they're going to try to go to 8K. But anyway, that's the thing. Like, you know, there's something about the attention span. And I know this has been talked ad nauseum, but people scroll through images and you're lucky if your image gets one second of attention.
Right. I mean, I started this as an experiment partially. So I got into woodworking a couple years ago and at the same time, I was looking at Instagram and I was saying, should I start an account with my landscape photography and my car photography? But I was like, that area is so saturated on Instagram. There's so many people posting. If you want, and I was reading some articles, and it's like, if you want something, you need to get into a niche area. I was like, well, I'm doing this woodworking. Like, I'm getting into this and I like collecting old stuff. I started getting into collecting old tools. And it's sort of my escape into a physical reality, which we don't have in the computer. So I build stuff out of old tools, all hand tools, all joinery, no screws, no nails, whatever. So I started doing photography of this stuff. I started posting this to my Instagram account. And, you know, it's been fun, but I started like realizing like what types of images, like gearing my photography towards Instagram, towards square. I started going square, which I've never done before. Mm-hmm. I started going like gearing my image choices towards what would be attractive in that type of a composition and the lighting and like all that stuff. And I realized like I was changing my style for that.
Yep. It was interesting because I did a video a while back where we were doing something and it was one of those behind the scenes things. Right. And the place we were doing this behind the scenes video, they were a place that does a lot of YouTube videos as well.
Right.
Right. And, but the way I was doing my behind the scenes was a lot more kind of interesting interview, classic behind the scenes video style. And I showed it to them and the edit, they were like, I don't know. And they decided like, can we see the edit? And I don't know why I agreed, but they decided to do their own version of the edit, and it was so freaking fast, frenetic, and cheesy.
Oh yeah.
And they're like, and I'm like, oh yeah, they'd make YouTube videos.
Yeah.
And that is such a different style of editing. I'm like, hello, beep, beep, beep. You know, when someone can talk and their face is interrupted 16 times in a shot because they keep cutting out everything, and like, bup, 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 and everyone's like, you're cool with that? Like, that looks terrible.
Yeah.
But no, they like it, you know, and that's a different style.
Right. Or it's like working on a movie where an action sequence, every shot is 3 frames long.
Right.
But they still have 8 frames of handles.
Oh my God. Yes.
Those are always fun.
That's fun. You have to composite 200% more of what the actual frame is. Yeah. Yeah.
Like a 6 frame long shot, and they still want to keep 10 frame handles. Or,
So it's 26 frames, even though you're only keeping 6 frames. But yeah, that's interesting.
But like where there's 10 cuts that are like 6 frames in a row.
Right, right, right. Yep. 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 Well, listen, there's a role, you know, that maybe, you know, I don't want to sound like the old fuddy-duddies, but maybe you and I could learn from, you know, this is a new aesthetic that people are going to do that. Maybe MP3s is a new way, you know, that the technology led people to like this aesthetically speaking, and then we should be accepting of that technology.
Right. I mean, as I said, I've changed my aesthetic more on the Instagram account more towards what's working.
I mean, you already made the transition from film to digital anyway.
Yeah, I did do that. Right. And I haven't touched film since. I just honestly don't have the time for it.
Right.
You know,
did you hear recently that Canon just announced they're making their last film camera?
I was surprised they were still making a film
camera. I didn't, I know.
I was like, really? That didn't part happen 10 years ago? Part of me was like,
oh, I can't believe that. Wait a minute, they still make a film camera?
Yeah, yeah. No, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So, but there you go, right? That's the thing. So eventually all these things will change, right? And then at some point we're going to say, people still make photographs? Why isn't this all just in VR or whatever?
It's all in what? Like, crazy capture of reality we have in the future. Yeah.
So who knows where that's going to be. What's when you're looking to the future, what are you thinking about? What are you thinking about doing? Like in terms of like, you know, capturing things or whatever, you still want to keep doing the kind of things you're doing, or do you
your
time lapses and obviously.
Yeah. I mean, I want to get back a little bit, swing it back a little bit more towards stills. And I still want to shoot a lot of time lapse. I mean, I have a ton of gear. I want to shoot a lot of that stuff. I enjoy that, but you know, I do find it interesting. I'll go somewhere beautiful and I'll set up my time lapse cameras and I'll be like, oh, I got to relax for a little bit. That was a lot of work setting up cameras for 2 hours.
Right.
But I won't shoot any stills the whole time I'm there or something.
Right.
So I do want to get back into stills a little bit. But then again, sometimes the traditional landscape, it's starting to bore me a little bit and I want to try to do something. So I think I've also gotten into the astrophotography stuff and nighttime stuff. And that's another level of complexity that I can sort of both enjoy artistically and geek out on technically.
So let's go into astrophotography a little bit. You're using a standard camera with a big lens on it, right?
Yeah.
And just using long exposures.
Well, so for the time lapse, I may do a 10 or 20 second exposure, but what I've been playing a little bit with is doing a standard camera, standard like a telephoto lens, but I'll put it on a star tracking mount.
Yep.
And then I'll take 30 shots and I'll stack and median them in Photoshop.
Right.
And all the noise goes away. And then you can stretch it and you can pull out the colors out of nebula with a standard, you know, 100mm lens pointing at like Andromeda. Or
Andromeda is actually pretty big.
It is. It's bigger than the moon. Yeah. But like the North American Nebula, or there's a lot of, there are several of them that are like, or you can even get like some of the stuff around Orion.
Yeah.
And if you stack up enough images and you've tracked with it and median out the noise, it's amazing what you can pull out of it.
Yep.
With the standard kit.
I had a friend of mine, it's interesting because he was also a photographer guy and I learned a few things. This is before when I was still in architecture at Gensler. His name was Mark Briggs and he did medium format stuff, et cetera. But he also built his own telescopes.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
And I was like, and I knew he did a lot of photography. So he's like, we should mount a camera to this thing. And he says, I didn't build a camera. I built a telescope. And his whole point was the telescope had a big enough aperture that you could see things with your naked eye. And that's
so
a big deal.
So that you could see with the eye, you didn't have to use a multiple exposure
and
camera.
And seeing with your naked eye is actually quite breathtaking. And you can never take that away.
Yeah.
But I did see your astrophotography stuff and I'm like, yeah, that's actually freaking brilliant. Yeah. If you have a good star tracker.
It doesn't even, the one I have, it's like $300.
Right.
It's a Polary Vixen. Just look that up.
Yeah.
And it's like, you just align it with the North Star and it just moves and you just throw a camera on
it's
there.
It's a German equatorial mount, right?
Yeah. Some kind. It's a box.
Right.
It's a tiny little box that fits in your camera bag.
Right.
And it has a little scope that you can mount in it or it has a little peephole.
Right.
And you just point it and go. And it's not a like a complex mount with a whole setup. It just goes on your tripod.
Right.
You throw the camera on it and you can shoot stars.
Mark made something called a German equatorial mount.
Yes.
Which is a little bit more complicated. Right. But what's cool about it is that it's literally lined up to the rotation of the Earth. So
yeah.
It only has one single gear
right.
that rotates the whole thing.
Right.
That's timed to, you know, the rotation.
That's what
of
this
Earth.
Is, but it's the size of a you know, it's right. like the size of a camera body.
And what he did, and this was all he machined this whole himself, right?
That's nice.
So he had I think the mirror size was 18 inches. So it's a big ass telescope, right? And so he made this German equatorial mount thing.
Yeah.
And the way he lined it up to the North Star, which is what you want to do because that's not rotating in the sky, is you
would, a fraction of a degree off of it, but yes.
Right. It's pretty close.
Yeah.
Close enough.
Yeah.
he mounted a green laser.
Right.
So that he could point it towards the North Star, and it was all analog, and like, and then you just turn the motor on, and you didn't have to worry. You don't even have to think about it.
Yep. I mean, if I had a spare $5,000, well, I'd spend it on a lot of things, but one option could be a telescope because I would love to get into that stuff and then another level of geeking out and technical, because then you get into star trackers that will actually update that rotation and keep it even more accurate.
Mm-hmm.
So you can image Jupiter and get the details of the planet.
Right.
And you have to get really stabilized with that. And there's a whole other thing with that. But anyways, lots of geeking out. But yeah. there are so many different ways I'd want to geek out, continue to. And
That's awesome. See, there's so many more things you can do.
Yeah.
You got that.
There's always more.
I'm
telling my 4-year-olds, it's like, it's all about learning new things. Let's figure out something new. Let's do something new and learn.
Yeah, it's fun. Yeah. It's fun. I think that's great. And I think, you know, even... You know, as you and I are getting older, we realize like, hey, there's still a lot that we can do and learn. So it's fun. It's absolutely fun.
If budgets were only unlimited.
Yeah, but sometimes.
Oh, yeah. You don't need unlimited budgets to learn things, but it's for the gearhead in me.
I know. But hear me out. having it's like art restrictions. Having like, I can't afford that right now.
The constraints,
The constraint. You're like, let's see what I can do with what I have now.
Yeah.
And then maybe I'll save enough to do that. So that time of waiting and planning or finding alternatives is actually part of the fun. Because if here's, you know, $25 million, do whatever you want with it, it won't be as fun.
It won't. And part of the fun is learning the basics when you're doing the DIY so that when you get the money to do something bigger, you know how it works.
Exactly. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Like machining or something and starting off with a very basic... You know, lathe or a bare, hand
screw.
Crank. making a screw and, but machining with the hand crank CNC, you know, or mill, I mean, hand cranked mill.
Yep.
And learning doing that before you get into the CNC.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Like Aruna.
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. He's made Rubik's cubes and stuff like that.
Yeah. But he started off like his little hand and he built it up. So
I should get Aruna on this podcast.
Yes. Too. He would be great.
He's doing a bunch of VR stuff now, right?
Yes. He's the VR guy.
He's the VR guy over at DD.
Yes.
All right. Well, listen, Aaron, we're way over, but this has been awesome having you on. Thanks so much for coming.
Yeah.
It's been good. And thank you for lending me your H6 and giving me the right path for me to make my podcast a travelable show. And
I'm glad.
I really appreciate all that help.
I want to hear all the new ones you're going to do.
I know, especially on the road.
Yes. Yep.
All right. Well, thanks, Aaron.
Thanks a lot, Chris.